I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Are higher gas prices beginning to affect where people choose to live? According to Scott Bernstein, yes, they are, and the effect will only grow greater. Scott is the president for the Center of Neighborhood Technology. We'll speak with Scott about the true cost of commuting and the toll it takes on your wallet and your time. What's the pulse of your city 24 hours a day? Next American City aims to find out. The magazine's 24-hour cities project has participants scouring a variety of cities for an entire day, scouting out the best things to do at every hour. We'll talk with editor Diana Lind about her magazine's staff upcoming trip to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Plus, we'll bring you audio art from the theater company Dog and Pony. All that plus our regular contributor, Nate Berg, coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Scott Bernstein is the president of the Center for Neighborhood Technology, where he's developed the Housing and Transportation Affordability Index, a report and an interactive mapping tool that lets you see how the cost of transportation affects your life. Scott, new research from the Center for Neighborhood Technology shows that people who live close to transit, jobs, schools, and retail, typically in cities and in inner ring suburbs, spend up to $2,100 less annually on gas than residents of outer ring suburbs, where homes and amenities are generally more spread out, require more driving. Is that now significant enough for people to change their decisions about where they live?
Well, sure it is. That's real money. I mean, you're talking about a 10 to 20% reduction in the cost of living, or to put it a different way, a 10 to 20% increase in disposable income tax-free.
And are you beginning to see evidence that people are making different decisions about where they choose to live?
Yes, not only our research, but it's a pleasure to read the regular coverage in the Tribune on the real estate markets. And if you look closely on where prices are going up, stable, or dropping, you find that stable prices or increased prices tend to be in locations that are walkable or adjacent to the transit networks, and the ones that aren't as convenient just aren't holding their value as well.
Tell me about the way you approach the research.
Well, the way we look at the research is a function of how we look at cities. I mean, cities are places that have reasons for people to want to be close to each other. We figured there had to be some good reasons to want to live on top of each other. And and you take a close look and you find a pretty standard market basket of motivations. For one, the density that cities provides makes it easier to get around on foot. The things you do and where you live are just closer to each other. And so at least you have choice in that sort of situation, given that only one trip out of five taken by automobile or transit is for the journey to work, and four out of five trips are for shopping or school or recreation or just general convenience. Having stuff close to you gives you the choice to not have to drive. We find that cities represent opportunities for meaningful work, for diversified work, that cities provide the kinds of supply networks that make it possible for businesses to do business with each other. You know, cities provide workforces. Businesses need labor, need people in order to work. And moving out to the exurbs basically led to a situation today where the number one complaint of business owners is finding a dependable, retainable workforce. And I could go on like that. There's social networks in cities. There are more intangible assets, tradition and culture. There's community organizations, big topic these days. These are the things that you need for community. You know, we find, as have other pollsters, that if you spend a lot of money polling people on the question of density, you find out that Americans hate density. They hate sprawl, but they love something called community. And they're willing to have a conversation about it. So the question in our mind is, how do you put a metric on that? We gave a highfalutin name to this urban quality. We called it location efficiency and set about the business to try and figure out whether the things we're talking about pan out in terms of a set of transportation-related indicators and found out that what we could measure rather reliably and right down to the address level was how many cars per household people own, how many vehicle miles those cars traveled per year, and how much other kinds of transportation other than driving people had to engage in, and what all those things cost. We learned how to arrange that data geographically. This is what geographic information systems are good for. And then spatially, we were able to turn things like cars and vehicle miles traveled and transit trips into dollars spent per household per year. We started out by doing that with 1 million household records in metropolitan Chicago, 2 million in San Francisco, and 3 million in metropolitan LA, and came up with an impenetrably dense equation that became a lot easier to understand once we drew a curve that showed that the higher the location efficiency, the lower the need to drive every year. Very reliably, the equation predicted this 92% of the time. And by predicted, I meant matched up the measured data we've got on how many cars people own and how much they were driving them. And we just kept extending the research. All the time we were extending it, we were also testing it. We cooked up a new kind of mortgage product based on this thinking, location-efficient mortgages that allowed people to borrow more money at lower cost as a function of the extra money they had in their pocket from living in a more convenient location that was tested in about 50 cities around the country successfully and way outperformed the market, virtually no defaults or foreclosures. We developed a new index of housing affordability, since that's another area where transportation costs and location efficiency and the benefits of cities aren't taken into account. Today, we have this data running in a website that your listeners are welcome to use free of charge. Just type in the following address into an address bar, htaindex, that's all one word, .cnt.org, and you'll get access to now 52 metropolitan regions. And you can take a look at the cost of transportation, the density of an area, gasoline prices. We've updated right to June 30th, 2008, which is almost real time. You're able to actually see what your neighborhood is experiencing in the way of the cost of housing and the cost of transportation and why. Right down to the census block group level. Very fine-grained. And I think we're the first, and I'll bet you we won't be the last group to have come up with this kind of approach to making new knowledge available.
Let me ask you something, Scott. You've identified this information, and you think with a great deal of certainty. You've actually developed a mortgage product based on it. I'm curious how you imagine this finally sort of sinking through public policy and in a very broad way.
Well, it seems to me that what happens is that policymakers, whether these are members of Congress or federal appointees or governors or state cabinet secretaries or mayors and department heads, are struggling desperately with the race against time to deal with two seemingly different but very related at their cause problems. One is a non-sustainable economy. And the other is the challenge of climate change. I mean, I'll take the second one first. We're down to less than 5 years before it's too late to get some of these bigger policies in place, to get the kinds of commitments that we need to drastically reduce carbon emissions in the atmosphere, at least 25% by 2020, and at least 80 and maybe 90% by 2050. By the same token, I think all the incomes are now below average, as Garrison Keillor would say, across the United States. This isn't a good sign. You know, I like to get an honest read of what's going on, so I read the Bond Buyer every day. I read the regular releases from economy.com and the three rating services. And I got to say, the news out there is kind of grim. Now, if we were talking about going on a diet, we'd be talking about belt tightening. And in a sense, this is part of the problem. We've developed some cultural norms for levels of consumption that are non-sustainable economically and environmentally. The good news in all this is that what you need to do to solve one is largely congruent with what you need to do to solve the other. If we get development patterns right, if we make more of the cities that we've got, there'll not only be this extra 10 to 20% in people's pockets available for both making ends meet and even creating a little more wealth, but there'll be much, 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 much lower impact on the environment and much lower carbon emissions. I think that's one of our critical findings.
I don't know if you've done this calculation, but I'm kind of curious if you looked at the 10 to 20% increase in disposable income that would come from location efficiency. Have you compared that to the economic stimulus?
Well, we did. I don't have the specific numbers in front of me right now, but that big national release that U.S. PERG put out earlier in the year was done by us. I think the stimulus went up in smoke in about the first 30 to 60 days. I mean, it's terrible. Some people got the full amount, and the full amount meant more to some people than to others. But on average, you were talking about, a few hundred dollars back in an economy where the average run-up in gas prices was $2,100. But if you were median income or 80% of median income and you'd taken the bait any time in the last few years to become a first-time homeowner in one of the far reaches of the collar counties here, your run-up could have been more in the $4,000 to $6,000 range.
Wow. In the collar counties of Cook County or Chicago?
Most of Chicago's excellent transit system is located in Cook County. There's obviously ribbons that stretch throughout all the counties, but the overwhelming majority of the communities in the collar counties of Lake McHenry, Kane, and DuPage County are not location efficient. There may have been some location efficiency there. There's street grids. They had streetcars at one point that are long gone. Most of these places' growth was planned around access to the expressway network. This isn't good news. Let me give you a real simple example. It's 10 o'clock at night. You live in an exurb. The place was built in a hurry. There isn't really a street network. There's one good street leading out of the development, and it takes you to one of the interstates. And it takes you there because nothing is zoned for anything but residential. But you can hop on the expressway, and 10 miles down the road is all the convenience in the world, right? 10 miles there, 10 miles back. Average fleet efficiency in Chicago is still only 20 miles to the gallon. Therefore, you're talking about 1 gallon of gas, right? 1 gallon of gas at $4 a gallon is just added $4 to your $3 and something gallon of milk on sale. Just doubled the price. Not good. How far do you think the stimulus check's going to go?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. At one point, there was an argument made that we need to disperse jobs out of the central city to the edges because that's where people were living and we needed to put them closer to work. And yet it seems as if, while that may have made theoretical sense, what happened is that people live in one suburb, but they don't necessarily work there. People change jobs a lot, so they may be working close to home and, on the first pass, but, third job into it, they're working in a far-flung suburb where the only way to get there is by car. And I'm wondering if you think, looking back on it, would it have made more sense or would it make sense, more sense going forward, to really concentrate jobs in hubs that are also transit hubs?
Absolutely. Well, I grew up in Park Forest, 35 miles south of downtown Chicago. My father always worked downtown running camera stores on Wabash Avenue and commuted in on the Illinois Central. But there were no jobs of the sort that he was good at to be had out in the south suburbs. There's one study that shows that when a central city's employees and their families relocate to an exurb, that the number of daily trips taken increases by a factor of 10.
Wow.
Now, this shouldn't be surprising if you think about it. Remember I said, first of all, that only one trip out of five is for the journey to work to begin with, and you're moving from a more organized to a more dispersed and random access kind of situation. I'm surprised it's only 10 times. You're in motion a lot if you live out there. Now, on the job side, after World War II, during the Cold War, there was even a tax credit for a while to critical industries to encourage them to disperse at least 50 miles out from central cities, which sort of tells you how bad things were. I mean, people were worried about cities being too dense in terms of being strategic targets. It's part of the early argument for a national defense highway system. It doesn't make a lot of sense. If we think about the way this stuff's been taught in school for 50 years, ever since Edward Hoover coined the phrase spatial mismatch, we talked about a policy choice being bringing either people to jobs or jobs to people. Well, that contest was won hands down. I mean, we have nothing but a system designed to bring people to jobs. And employers, I think, are getting smart. It's been less than 10 years since British Petroleum bought out Amoco and moved 1,200 executives out to the edge of DuPage County near Kane County. And if you caught the announcement last month, they're moving back downtown next door to Boeing, quote, to be close to the train stations, unquote, which is also why Boeing picked Chicago over Denver and Dallas. You notice that we've had two steel mills now, Finkel and one other, announced that they were moving and deciding to stay within the city limits of Chicago, citing, again, workforce and transit accessibility. The run-up in the price of land, even speculative land, near transit stops is fantastic in Chicago. And what's really interesting is how remarkably underutilized that land is. Not only on the extremely depressed parts of the west and south side of Chicago, but the newer lines like the Blue Line extension to O'Hare and the Orange Line out to Midway were built according to suburban form. And so these are park and ride lots with large bus turnaround facilities. And you know which station on the whole system has the highest daily ridership?
Which one?
O'Hare.
Ah.
You can't lose. You got the entire world aviation system dumping people into it. You see, this is the difference between thinking about transit systems as nodes in a network versus stations and station areas as places that need to intercept the value in the local economy. You absolutely have to do both, and you have to do them real well, or you don't win. And so far, we've been real good at developing new systems and dumping lots of people in them off of cars, planes, and buses, apparently. But that's kind of a perverse incentive. What we really need to do is think about all that land as banked land that could potentially serve a very large fraction of the population that's coming here.
We'll have more with Scott Bernstein in a minute, but first, something a little bit different. Dog and Pony is a theater company that has created a different way to explore a city with its Sound City project. The project is an interactive theater piece that draws attention to movements and participants in Chicago's political history. Audience members use a map to guide them to locations and then listen to poetry, audio art, music, and radio drama that interprets the artist's favorite locations in the city. In this piece, composer and poet Catherine Zwick performs a piece about the famous Jane Addams Hull House.
One, you saw the threads of people stretched out across the miles, and you made a loom. The Hull House welcomed people through. You turned not one away, whether drunken or addled with illness or insanity or immobilizing fear or poverty or lack of religion or rejected sexuality. Your threshold was the doorway to an intersection of individuals given names, faces, and new hope in a city that would rather forget them. All this weaving and braiding that you did became a 40-year-long rope. The many-colored, the many-tongued, tied stronger still together because they walked through your gate. Like the children who, hot in the summertime, amble to the Hull House for safe days spent while their parents worked long hours. In this way, the Hull House opened the first full-time daycare center in the country. Like the mothers, who so loved their abusive husbands they would labor pitilessly for 15 hours a day to support them, but turned to the Hull House when they could no longer stand the hard hands and gravel tones. The Hull House also functioned as a battered woman's shelter. like the women who were too proud of their respective cultures to take food handouts. So you designed cooking classes whereby women would come and cook the food themselves and thus feel as though they had a hand in providing their families with meals. These are the lines of the rope that keeps us together even now. We hold tight to the strength that you braided for the bettering. 2. Dear Jane, sipping coffee in my 21st century studio, I am a single woman looking for the difference I can make. I look to you now, that great Chicago saint. You woke our country up, and now, so many years later, we have forgotten the sound of the alarm. You brought forth legislation recognizing the rights of children, minorities, and laborers. You put in the minds of the government their voices, so loud and so persistent that congressmen and senators and Supreme Court justices could not get a good night's sleep without hearing those shouts for equality, freedom, liberty ringing through their fitful heads. You recognized that fundamental right of each human being to be seen as an equal and a justified participant in the best our nation has to offer. You gave without reservation, your palm always open to shake hands, to share bread and prayer, to hold children dying of neglect and women driven to starvation. We have not yet finished your work, Jane. Your words and actions made way for the suffragettes, the second wave of feminism, the civil rights movement, and gay rights today. The alarm is still sounding. The bell you swung is still ringing, and we should take heed your words, your offerings of peace and equality, of integrity and insight. Sipping coffee in my 21st century studio, I am a single woman looking for the difference I can make. Mostly, I want to stay awake, want to put my hand on the cuff of the bell and shake the world out of its groggy state, step into your legacy with grace, be fit to call myself your friend. 3. They were disparate and aching in a city that had turned its big shoulders. At that time, immigrants were nameless, anonymous masses on the Southwest Side, simply an amalgamation, not a people, and not important. The Italian, the Russian, the Bohemian, the Romanian, the Irish, later the Mexican, the Black. They were scorned first and worth only what their bodies could manufacture in sweatshops, brothels, and bars. Playgrounds were nutty ideas. Children were not children at all, but potential factory workers. Before you, John, immigrant women were not thought of at all, but if they were, it was as mindless mothers or laboring chattel. The working week extended beyond 80 hours for children whose backs did not know how to straighten, whose fingers were pinched claws lacking play or sleep. The law did not protect anyone but the owners, the incorporated, and the lobbyists' deep pockets, which, with every younger worker, became deeper all the while. But your hand designed liberty, a hard fist when it needed to be, and then, from fist to charity, like a cracked egg, an exploded stone, or the beginning of all that is, you, the first mover, you sounded the bell. And to this day, that chorus echoes in our ears.
Catherine Zwick is the artist behind that piece from Dog and Pony Theater Company's Sound City. You can get a link to more Sound City and to Dog and Pony Theater Company on our website, smartcityradio.com. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll have more from my conversation with Scott Bernstein from the Center for Neighborhood Technology. Plus, what is there to do at 4 a.m. in Milwaukee? We'll find out from Next American City Magazine's Diana Lind. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Let's get back now to my interview with Scott Bernstein of the Center for Neighborhood Technology. Before the break, he told us about how to uncrack the value in the land now owned by your transit agency. If you look at the land owned by or land that's ripe for development that would be owned by the Chicago Transit Authority, how much land would that be?
Well, I wish I had that plug figure, but it's a lot. I can answer it, though, in terms of outcome. We did a national study with the Center for Transit-Oriented Development where we looked at all 3,300 existing and 700 developing transit station areas in the United States. This is a half-mile circle around each one of those. And then we looked at the population projections down to the census block group level done by Woods and Poole, which have become the reference for these projections. And then we looked at the demographic characteristics in the demand file that generate those projections, and we matched them up with the demographic characteristics of people who are actually buying and renting a housing near transit in the United States. And we allocated that as a demand for transit from the year 2000 to 2030 within each region. Now, this doesn't tell you anywhere in particular people are actually going to move. But what it does tell you in the Chicagoland area is that between 2000 and 2030, there will be an increase of at least 800,000 households who will want to live within walking distance of a rail transit station. That's a lot. That's the entire population projection. We're high in Chicago and in New York and in Los Angeles and in D.C., Boston, and Philadelphia, because those are the most extensive regional transit systems, which means they cover the largest fraction of the region by far, and they connect better to each other than most do. The numbers can be quite different in across the 50 or so places that have transit or are developing them. But what's interesting about it is it says, here's a goal worth shooting for, right? I remember we did our own projection before we had that detailed number, just based on the amount of land that the Northeastern Illinois Planning Commission, now part of the Chicago Metropolitan Agency on Planning, had back in the early 90s. And we came up with about a number of about 97% of the population projection could fit within walking or shuttle distance of rail transit stations.
That's an incredible savings when you think about
it. Right. And NPSE itself, the agency, did a much more conservative projection, and it still came up with 92%. So I think that, you know, that's worth thinking about. Now, sprawl has slowed down somewhat, but I think it's because there just isn't as much money at the level of the state or the counties or the utilities, which are the three main sources for water, sewer, gas, electric, telephone, and transportation agencies. There just isn't as much money around to keep subsidizing this. Remember that roughly half of the cost of developing a home or a building in a greenfield is going to be the sum of infrastructure and land costs. And it's not all that much different in a city. The benefit to density is that you're spreading the same infrastructure costs among many more people per building, per block, or community. So it might cost you $60,000 to $100,000 to service a home in a cornfield, but it might only cost you $5,000 to $10,000 to upgrade existing infrastructure in a gray field or a brown field. And in an overbuilt suburb that has perfectly good infrastructure and will never see its full population complement, that stuff's drastically underutilized. You may have to upgrade nothing, and it's more of a plug-and-play situation, and the cost is negative. You can afford to pay somebody to move into a situation like that. Those are really big, deep potential savings. So you've got the savings from gas costs, the savings from having to own on net one less car per household. You've got the aggregate community savings of all that. You've got the savings associated with the tax base associated with not having to invest as inefficiently. And then you've got the positive benefits associated with a bigger economy to intercept, whether it's through taxes or fees or participation and ownership or all of those. You know, we haven't put the whole story together yet, but it's like we're running with one leg and one hand tied behind our back. I mean, it's silly to do business this way. I mean, I think we can be both more productive and cleaner and do it all more sustainably if we learn to think in these terms. And I think our little indicator research is just a validation of that way of thinking about cities.
Let me ask you one more question, Scott, and that is this. If you were consulting with a community that, let's say, is built on a typical post-50s sprawl pattern of development, what would you tell them to do to begin moving in a smarter way to recapture some of this money that's available that's now going into gasoline, to vehicle ownership, et cetera, and is creating what you call a non-sustainable economy? What's the advice?
Well, the first thing I would do is to get them to take stock and look sort of unemotionally at what the numbers tell them about what their exposure is to all of this. I mean, and exposure is a great metaphor. If you're built to make people own two or three cars per household and to stay in buildings that are uninsulated and inefficient, and you don't have amenities nearby, I mean, my honest answer is if you're not willing to change some of those things, give it up. I mean, in price of oil may be in a temporary lull. The long-term trend is up. You're going to be seeing oil prices in 2012. A friend of mine did a survey of economists around the world, asked them the question, only one question: what do you think the price of oil is going to be in 2012? The low end was 177, and the high end was 504. So some of these exurbs just aren't going to make it under their current configuration. I'd say you're going to see a lot of very low demand for housing and amenities way out there, unless something changes. I mean, you could end up with networks and more self-sufficiency, less exposure, better street networks, better amenities, more people working at home. But there's got to be a reason to live out that far. And unless you start to learn to redistribute those amenities and the employment more logically, I just question whether all places are equally sustainable. That's what I tell them. Then I'd say, okay, look, you could do this. People actually do spend a lot of money in a, let's say, a 10,000 household community with an average income of $50,000 a year. I mean, I think we're talking about $5 billion a year there, something like that. So it's a lot of money, right? Maybe, 20% of that's going for the cost of food and there's no grocery stores within the village limits. Makes no sense. No sense whatsoever. Or the schools aren't quite what they're cracked up to be, so people are actually paying money to send their kids far away. Makes no sense. You know, you need 1.2 jobs per household. How many of those are located within the limits? Well, zero if it's your typical village. I mean, bedroom communities don't make a whole lot of sense in the 21st century. And I could go on like that, but you get your economic base right, and then you figure out what the most efficient way is to serve those needs. And if you're on the transit network and you're not getting great service, there's a lot you can do to up the connectivity and the frequency of service. Mm-hmm. Every place could do with some car sharing, which we've introduced into Chicago, a little fleet of 200 cars. Our members make very good use of these things. Each car we put out there is in active use by 37 households. 46% of them are either selling a car or delaying purchase within a year of joining. We're taking 17 cars net off the road for every car that we put out there. So you can't do as much of that in a low-density situation, but you could do some of it everywhere. You can add informal transit fleets by getting into van sharing. This is something you could do with SUVs and vans other than sell them. Just put them into greater use. We're looking at a situation where we may be able to get private vehicle owners to opt into our car share fleet. We'll retrofit their cars with the same equipment that allows people to rent the ones we own. Because, you know, let's face it, people don't use their cars most of the time. All right, so this would be extremely efficient asset management. So you'd end up with something where everybody would get some access to some vehicle all the time on demand, and then you'd work with Pace or other bus providers to provide some increase in scheduled service. If you're located on the rail network right here, the Metra is the name of the commuter provider, you could get some extra service there if you pushed for it. If not, maybe what you need is something more like a fixed guideway system to reconnect the suburbs to each other, which is what the interurban electric system used to be in Chicago until the early 50s. That's coming back too. For places that have bus networks and are dealing with the impossibility of rising fuel prices, I'd cut a deal with Commonwealth Edison to convert them to electric trolley buses. Edison gets the revenue from the electricity on a bus situation is more affordable and the cost is stable, less volatile. And if it works out, well, you got half the infrastructure you need with an overhead wire to convert to streetcars as you start to densify again. I think that what you're going to find if you do this sort of patient, place-by-place, detailed scorekeeping is that every place could do a whole lot better. You know, it's like the story about going on a diet. So I'm going to end with a story for you. There was a woman named Ellen Swallow Richards in the 1880s who became the first woman to earn a PhD in chemistry in the United States, and we're living with two of her inventions today. One is the calorie counter, which I really don't want to talk about. And the other is the idea of a standard household budget. She was the founder of the modern home economics movement in the United States. And Ellen and her compatriots set a goal, which they achieved, of having at least a third of adult Americans by 1920 having learned through home economics classes in the public schools how to construct and use a standard household budget, how to set goals, and how to get ahead. It's really amazing to sort of read the detail they went into. Always keep your car fare, which meant streetcar fare, at 3% of your income or less, which you could do with ubiquitous mass transit, and never ever, it said, go into debt for an automobile. And you know what happened to home ec, besides getting sex world stereotyped, was that by the 1950s it was getting squeezed out of the curriculum by driver's education. So now, instead of telling people how to minimize their expenditure, we're teaching 15-year-old kids how to go into debt for these things. And it's no wonder that they're the biggest victims of credit fraud by the time they hit college. So I think we can do a lot to create a climate of efficiency and productivity that creates sort of a win-win, double bottom line situation between doing better for you and your community's economy and at the same time doing what we need to make for a survivable planet. I think that's what this research shows, that the solutions to one are largely the solutions to another. There really isn't an excuse for not looking at things this way. We got to get organized and we got to learn to do it together if we're going to make the difference.
Scott, it's always great talking with you and catching up on what you're doing. So I appreciate you being our guest on Smart City.
Well, you're very welcome.
Scott Bernstein is the president of the Center for Neighborhood Technology. We'll have a link to his site, including the Housing and Transportation Affordability Index, on our site, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we go to Plan Edison Assistant Editor Nate Berg.
Mobility is changing. More and more people are using their cars less and less, and the rising costs of driving are starting to make people think twice before stepping on the gas. 5 or 10 years down the line, how and why people get around is likely to be a lot different than it is today. One place this will be really evident is at the convenience store. According to real estate analyst Jeff Patterson, the Quickie Mart of today will largely be gone from the future landscape. In a recent article in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal, he argues that auto-centric development like gas station convenience stores will die out, and transit-oriented locations will begin to flourish. These, quote, transit station marketplaces are going to be the 7-Elevens and the AM-PMs of the future, he says. And the owners of these convenience chains had better start thinking about the changing mobility patterns of their customers if they want to stay relevant and in business. Meanwhile, in Houston, the place widely known as America's biggest city without zoning, mixed use is coming to town. And it's coming in the form of traditional neighborhood developments. According to a recent article in the Houston Chronicle, a number of TNDs are popping up in and around town. These smaller master plan subdivisions, complete with corner shops, pocket parks, and narrow streets, offer a counterpoint to the huge, sterile, and cookie-cutter subdivisions that dominate the city. Three new urbanist developments, designed by architect Andres Duany, are expected to begin construction next year. Developers in town are hoping this new shape of subdivision will be a hit with Houston homebuyers. But with higher prices than typical subdivision homes and a rocky housing market, how well they sell remains to be seen. And finally, the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 caused a lot of cities to rethink their safety requirements. A broad building code update based on a 2005 report from the National Institute of Standards and Technology sought to improve fire safety measures and evacuation capabilities in skyscrapers. But now, 7 years after the attacks, the federal government's General Services Administration is coming out in opposition to the building code updates, arguing that they would cost developers too much to put in place. According to an article in the New York Times, the GSA is petitioning the International Code Council to lighten the new regulations when they vote on the building code update next week. Others argue the move doesn't make sense, saying the federal government is fighting on behalf of a group of developers to essentially make skyscrapers less safe. But regardless, the government is pushing forward, saying that the stricter rules were an unreasonable and emotion-based reaction to a devastating but extremely rare event. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor at Planetizen.com. Diana Lind is resting up for a marathon of city exploration. She's the editor of Next American City magazine, and this weekend she'll be spending the day and the night exploring the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin for the magazine's 24-hour cities project. Tell me, Diana, what will happen September 17th when Next American City goes to Milwaukee?
We're participating in a couple of different events, the first of which is we are sponsoring a lecture along with the local group called Fuel Milwaukee. And the lecture, it's actually like a panel discussion on transit and transportation in the local Milwaukee area. And that's an event where the panelists will make their presentations, and right after that, then all the people who have attended the lecture will gather at a couple of different tables and have one of the panelists at each of the tables discuss, you know, what was just talked about in the presentation. And then after that, there'll be a little bit of a Q&A session, and then finally some cocktails. So that is the first part of our trip. Then on Thursday, I'll be speaking at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at a class there, and then later talking with a local council member to try and get a sense of some of the pressing issues in Milwaukee. And then finally on Saturday, we are throwing our 24 hours psychogeography experiment hurrah, basically, where we walk around the city of Milwaukee for 24 hours. That's one of our most popular events that we throw in any given city that we visit. Basically, it's a free public chance for anyone who wants to come join us and walk with some local guides exploring the city. The event will basically run, I think, from about 10 in the morning till on Saturday till 10 in the morning the next day, Sunday. We'll walk around to kind of learn a little bit about the history of Milwaukee and then also kind of some of the local treats and try and get a sense of what's the word on the street. There's just no predetermined plan for the day, and it's just a really great chance to see a city in ways that you've never seen it before.
So what do you do at 4 a.m. in Milwaukee?
I have no idea, and I'm very happy actually we're doing this event in September, because I was just talking to somebody who's in Boston, and we're going up to Boston in November, and she said, I don't know that you should really walk around Boston in November for 24 hours. It's going to be very, very cold. So Milwaukee at 4 a.m., I don't really know. Maybe hopefully we'll find a diner. Maybe we could all hang out in a diner. Maybe there's a midnight movie somewhere, or like a fantastic party or a bar. It's really, it's up to the people who are there to try and figure out something fun to do. And I think also as a large group, there's interest in keeping it safe and accessible for everyone.
Well, cycling back to the lecture, what made you choose transit and transportation as your topic?
Actually, that was a topic that came to us, I believe, from Fuel Milwaukee, which is a local group that is interested in encouraging talented young professionals to stay in the Milwaukee area. And I think that they had suggested that this was a really pressing issue for the area. I believe that there is a new transportation line, the Hiawatha line, that is kind of a commuter rail that's being proposed between Milwaukee and Chicago, and there's real opportunity in the area to improve transportation and improve funding for it. So I think especially given the current gas crisis, transportation is on the minds of a lot of different cities. It just seemed really appropriate and timely.
You know, there are about 10,000 people who commute every day from Chicago to Milwaukee.
I did not know that.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they commute on, and many of them commute on the train.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you, this is not the first traveling event you've done. Where else have you been?
We've done two other events, the 24 hours events. We went down to New Orleans about earlier in 2008, I think around March or so. And before that, we had done another 24 hours trip in Philadelphia right here. It wasn't really traveling, but we're sort of figuring out this 24 hours project as we go along. And when we went to New Orleans, it was a really fantastic chance for us to learn more about how that city is recovering from Katrina in a way that isn't always presented by the media.
And when you complete your 24 hours in Milwaukee, what will you hope to have learned?
I think we'll have hoped to have learned a bit more about why this city is attractive to young people. Perhaps we'll try to get a sense of what are the burning urban issues in the area and try to figure out like what's exciting about the city. And I think what you get in the media about any given city is the controversies there. You don't necessarily get local stories about, just say, a youth orchestra that's particularly phenomenal in Milwaukee. We actually have a piece about that in our current issue of Next American City. But you might find that out just by walking into a local restaurant and talking to somebody there. So I think that it's a real opportunity for us to reach out to a small city and make an impression there, and likewise get an impression from them of what's going on.
On a broader note, tell me about some of the stories you have coming up in Next American Cities. What are you working on?
We just finished our 20th issue, and in that issue we have a piece also about transportation, about Amtrak. We also have a piece about the virtual cities of Second Life and other online games, and we have a piece about Youngstown, Ohio, and looking at that particular city and why it's been shrinking in size and how the city government is enlisting civic engagement to really change the growth there. In our future issues, we have a couple of additional themes like the affordability of cities, which is a pressing issue always, and the digital divide, the way that a lot of civic engagement has been conducted over the internet now, and a lot of life is really conducted in an invisible manner, and some people are being left out. And we also have a piece about the Atlanta Beltline project, which is a 20-year project to really transform the transportation system in Atlanta.
The affordability issue is an interesting one now. I know there are a lot of homeowners who wish, given the crash in housing prices, I think everyone would like to see their housing values go back up, wouldn't they?
Oh, definitely. I mean, housing, yes, has gone down, and that's become more affordable, I suppose. But a lot of other amenities in cities have become increasingly expensive, and as cities become so much more desirable to live in, the cost of living seems to have gone up, and we're really questioning whether is that necessary, and how could cities be involved in creating affordability for all different kinds of people.
Let me cycle back to your Amtrak story a minute, because a lot of us would love to see Amtrak expanded and service expanded, but you found some problems with Amtrak. What were they?
Basically, there hasn't been the kind of investment in Amtrak that the company really needs. And there hasn't been the kind of encouragement for mass transportation in the United States that there is in a lot of other countries around the world. And so I think that in many senses it hasn't been given a fair shake. It hasn't had its chance to really be the kind of link through cities. At the same time, I think that Amtrak isn't really doing a good enough job of getting its trains to any given destination on time. They've really kind of lagged behind in a lot of areas of customer service and really haven't stepped up to the needs of the 21st century in terms of presenting rail as a better option than driving.
You can have some strange customer service experiences with Amtrak, and that's putting it mildly. But at any rate, Diana, we love what you do at Next American Cities. Thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Diana Lind is the editor of Next American City. The 24-hour city project heads to Milwaukee September 20th. She joined us from her office in Philadelphia. You can find our website, smartcityradio.com, from your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your computer. And while you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Most importantly, you can get in touch with us and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our hairy but resourceful producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.